I have to start with something of an apology, and the apology is a mingled apology and confession, and it's that I didn't bring my glasses, and my arms are no longer long enough. Somehow, in the last year, they got too short to help me at times with reading passages, so I want to start with a passage, but I'm hoping my eyes don't fail me here. Matthew 9, 35 to 38. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." We really are going to talk about mega trends in missions today. But what I'd like to do first is start with what I'd like to call the three primary colors of a missionary heartbeat that we see here in this passage. It's kind of giving us a context into which to put these mega trends of mission. Now, the first color of a missionary heartbeat is the color of active engagement in the world. Jesus didn't see the people without having first ministered to them. He was active, going through all the towns and villages. As a matter of fact, when you look at this, this is a hinge passage that connects Matthew 5 through 9 to what takes place after Matthew 9 in chapter 10. And as you look at Matthew 5 through 7, you see the long, extended Sermon on the Mount. But then you get into chapters 8 and 9, and you have story after story after story of what Jesus was actually doing in the lives of people. So when you come to 9:35, this is not a new activity. This is a summary statement of what we've seen in chapters 8 and 9, talking about all the work and activity that Jesus has been involved with. So Jesus was actively engaged. Mission heartbeat is not built on sitting in an armchair. This is one of my temptations as a professor. I like to sit in my office and work and think and write and so on, but I'm tempted, as some of you won't believe this, a slight introvert, not to want to get out. Those who know me don't believe that, but that is a part of my personality. I'd prefer staying in the office all day at times, but this gives me a heartbeat of what Jesus did, and he doesn't let us do this. The second color is the color of compassionate vision. Compassionate vision. He's not just active in the lives of people, but he sees them as they are. He's willing to look beyond the mask that we all wear to try and get into the heartbeat. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. The person who is aggressively dominant is just as harassed and helpless as the person who is broken in their pain. Harassed and helpless by the enemy. Certainly seen in the circumstances of life, but more seen in the harassment that we have in our hearts that we carry with us. And this is what Jesus saw in the life of the... Am I going to be playing games with this the whole time? Or... I got the sinking one, didn't I? Jesus had a compassionate vision. The word that's used here is the same word used of his agony in Gethsemane, when he prayed that God would remove the cup from him. Okay, this one is tighter. I pushed it down some. I'm used to leaning on the pulpit, and that's not going to work too well here. I'm giving you a hard time. Does he look harassed and helpless right now? A compassionate vision that he had for the people, because he saw them as they were. And again, this word compassion, as I was mentioning, it comes out of the same word used in Gethsemane. It's a gut-wrenching, if you want to put it in a little bit more graphic term. He had a gut-wrenching feel for what was taking place. When you think of 1.3 billion people living in urban slums, shanty town housing, whose plumbing is the stream running down the middle of the path they walk to get home every day while looking for work, what kind of heartbeat do you have for that? But 1.3 billion is an overwhelming number. I can't imagine 1.3 billion people let alone 1.3 living in slums. Now, you're talking for them reaching the poverty line would be a significant increase in what they face in life. So for many of them, even getting to the line of poverty would be a major accomplishment. We're not talking about people just living. This is the desperately poor, often making their living off of sorting through the trash of others to find items to recycle that they can go sell. I have visions of times in Nairobi seeing children climb into dumpsters to find paper they could pull out and hand to somebody who had a big burlap bag that they would just stuff the paper into for recycling. But Jesus had compassionate vision. And the last color I want to point to is proactive prayer. Jesus said, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Again, that's part of his vision of seeing the way God sees the world. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send workers out into his harvest field. And of course, what happens in chapter 10? He sends the disciples right out. So we see these three elements, and what I'm hoping over the course of the month that we have together in dealing with mission, that we can kind of cultivate each of these in our own lives. Today, we're going to be focusing more on the compassionate vision side, to see the world as God sees it, to see the trends in mission in light of what's happening in the world. I have one ground rule, and I'm hoping it fits well with you, and the ground rule is that I'm interruptible. And so please feel free if you have questions or thoughts or comments, or you'd like to chase a rabbit trail. I love chasing rabbit trails, so don't let that worry you. Don't think any question or idea or thought is stupid. It never is. It's always an opportunity to hear from other people in the body to say, what are some ideas we'd like to share? I'm going to mention six world trends or mega trends and talk about the implications of these in the world, the implications of these in the church, and the implications of these in mission. I want to touch on them each very quickly here just so you know where I'm going to be going. The first one is a borderless global economy that we are more and more moving into. Interestingly enough, we like to complain on a regular basis as a so-called first world country of our trade imbalance of however many billions per year. Isn't it wonderful, however, that we as the richest country in the world are sending our money away and giving other things? Now, that might be a reverse connection of what you're thinking about global economy, but the reality is if we were receiving more money than we were giving out, I would be more worried about the status of the rest of the world than I am. Granted, a lot of that is with Japan. They need to be sending money out as well, too. But on one side, we are living in a borderless global economy which still faces vestiges of what many refer to as neocolonialism. I'll come back to that in a minute. New types of colonialism, where we don't necessarily politically dominate anymore, but I can talk about some ways that we do, but we economically dominate many parts of the world. And it's not just we. I'm talking about the West here in general, not just the United States. The second thing I want to look at is a cluster of trends all tied around some of the same issues. Migration, rogue nations, and you heard me call something neocolonialism. What I'll refer to here is now neo-tribalism. The resurgence of Nazism. In here, the United States, the rise of militia groups. Related to also then what we see is taking place in the former Soviet world, Bosnia in particular. And if any of you have insights on that, I'd love to hear them, because I haven't even been able to figure out how to think about that whole scene. There are so many different groups fighting so many different wars, I don't know what's going on. And every time a newscast comes out, I get confused trying to think through what is taking place, who's killing who, and who's justifying the killing in what ways. But that's the second cluster of trends that I see in the world that I'd like to at least touch on. If you have a favorite of one of these things that you'd like to pull me back to, please feel free to do that. I'm just giving you in the order I'm going to walk through them. The third thing that I see is a mega trend that's really more in the West, but is beginning to move out, is the information age that we are part of. By the way, just as the rich get richer applies in economics, it also seems to apply in information. What we have accessible to us here is something that others can't even dream of because they don't know such things even exist at this point in time. From my office, I can go to just about any major library in the world that has an online library catalog and get into their library card catalog and figure out what they have. I can access a large database that lets me know which of the 32 million books that it has access to I might want and which libraries they're in. And with another click of a button on my computer, I can order those books through interlibrary loan. Isn't that wonderful? I never have to leave my office anymore. The dehumanization of mission professors might be a way to think of that as a trend, though it's not a global trend yet. But the information age is something that is going to have an increasingly important impact on the world. By the way, this is becoming accessible also to many missionaries. We'll talk about this in a couple of minutes. But MAF, Mission Aviation Fellowship, has decided to double their thrust. They're no longer just aviation, but they want to be on the cutting edge of missions information technology. And they're processing well over 1 million email messages a month through their total system right now, which gives you an idea how many missionaries are taking advantage of that. East Africa alone, in the month of November of 1995, they processed over 100,000 messages. I was probably 300 of those, but because I had a lot of friends in East Africa from my time there. The fourth major issue that will be of greater and greater significance for missions and the church as a whole is world religion. And I want to hit two sides of the world religions. One is increasingly evangelistic thrust by non-Christian religions. And in part because of a response to what the church has been doing. They see the evangelistic version of the church and they realize that they are losing some ground, and so we're starting to see a resurgence in evangelism on the part of world religions. And secondly, we're seeing a resurgence of a militant approach to being a religious adherent as well, too. And certainly, when I say that, probably one of the first things that comes to your mind is fundamentalist Islam, for whatever reason. But that would be one of the expressions that we're seeing it. But it's not just limited to Islam. The fifth major mega trend that I will mention is crime and what it does to world economy. It is estimated by some researchers that we spend $4.5 trillion per year, all related to crime, dealing with fraud, the loss through fraud, and then the response to have to police fraud. $4.5 trillion per year. The same researchers estimate that approximately 12% of that total would feed every person in the world. Approximately $500 billion. And yet we spend $4.5 trillion, not spend, but $4.5 trillion goes into crime. Yeah. A little church. I know what you mean, but a lot of times I hear we're just a drop in the bucket, but if you get enough drops, you can fill a bucket. It's part of the way I like to look at that. And with no drops, the bucket will never be full. In one respect, it's making sure that we maintain our own integrity internally. And certainly when I look at it, I'll mention this as well too. Ecclesiastical crime by the same researchers is estimated at the year 2000 to run $13 billion per year. The total mission worldwide budget, $12 billion per year. We have more issues related to crime in the church that's taking more of our resources than world missions is right now. And Tony, to answer that question, I guess I'd say, let's start looking in-house. I don't think, Jack, am I going to get in trouble by saying that? They have to look at you? No. Right. You're clean. Okay. But then also, what are ways we can begin to address issues, even among ourselves? I'd say, in one respect, the thing we need to watch is, in part, within the church, but as members of the church go out, in what ways am I living a life that's pleasing to God out in the world as well? In what ways am I tolerating crime in my company, in my organization? In what ways might I be even participating in that? On one side, I say we're never going to overcome crime until the Lord returns, because it's something only God can do. On the other side, I want to say, let's not think that we have nothing to say about it, however. And I don't think the issue is necessarily building more jails, to put a bunch more criminals in. All that does is continue to increase the amount of money spent dealing with crime. But it's more looking at the human heart and trying to find ways where we can infect the human heart so that other people become agents of righteousness as well, too. We can come back to that one, but that's one I have the least amount to say about it as a whole, but it's one that we need to be willing to see as a huge trend that's going to continue. It's not going to slow down from anything I can see. The last thing is not as much a world trend as it is what I'm calling life trends here in the West. What are some things we're seeing? I just had the privilege of participating in an organizational conference for a group that's going to be known as finishers. It doesn't mean they're done. But this group is a group of looking, it's a group that's looking to mobilize the boomer generation that's in between the ages of 45 and 60 right now that's facing retirement, many of whom are tired of the rat race. They're looking for significance in their lives. Missions is a wonderful place to find significance, to be sensing that they're being used of God, but many of them aren't aware that missions might be a career. It's estimated as many as 4 million people in this category, who are evangelical Christians, ready to retire. And are our mission agencies even ready to consider how to recruit them? Well, this conference is going to be launching a pilot next year that the Navigators will be sponsoring, probably next summer here in the Chicago area. They're hoping to draw 1,000 and hoping to use this as a staging platform. This is kind of a test conference, so to speak. They're looking for maybe a conference of 8 to 10,000 by the year 2000. Of people that are all boomers, that would be an Urbana type of conference, giving them the chance to see what's going on. Well, that's one of the things we can talk about, the things that are taking place here in the West. But as many of you probably already heard, that generation of boomers doesn't necessarily get along well with this generation of Xers that many of you represent, and how do we deal with some of those issues? So those are the six trends that I'm going to touch on: a borderless global economy, the migration, neo-tribalism, and rogue nations that we're seeing, the political realities of today's world, the information age that we're a part of, world religions becoming more militant and more evangelistic, the fact of crime and ecclesiastical crime fitting into that picture, and then life trends in the West. And as I look at the time, I realize there's no way we're going to cover all this. So I want you to help me set the agenda by saying, what are some things you'd like to look at, and which of these would you like to maybe have me touch on more in detail? And if you want to give me some suggestions, I'll work from there. Yeah. Okay. We'll start with the last one first and move up that way. I want to mention four trends in the West that at least I see that are having a direct impact on missions. These are not trends that necessarily are all that's happening in the West. The first is a return to magical thinking. And in part, we're seeing this with the popularity, for example, in the church of the Peretti-type novels. But the larger culture is into spirituality, however that is defined, and it's defined about a zillion different ways by the larger culture. But part of that spirituality and approach to life is magical thinking. And even as my wife and I were watching Channel 11 last night, a Harvard graduate who works at the University of Arizona Medical School teaching alternative health, trying to get people to think new ways to think their bodies into wholeness. Well, there are certain elements of this that are appropriate, but other elements where he's looking into magical practices in many parts of the world to find things that will help him understand how to deal with it. Well, this is kind of taking off within the West in alternative health, but we see it in the church as well, too. And one of the places we see it, I want to be careful how I say this because this is not always bad, but we see this in one respect in the rise of the Pentecostal and the Charismatic Church movement. That is the single largest block, according to David Barrett, who's a well-known researcher in this area, the single largest block of the conservative evangelical church movement worldwide is the Charismatic Pentecostal group. But we're seeing this on levels in missions in terms of people, say, wanting to engage in prayer against territorial spirits. So that's a trend we're seeing within missions. And I've got a friend in India who is an Indian who returned after 25 years here in the States to his country, and he says one of the biggest problems he faces right now is putting out the fires of well-meaning Christians who come and do prayer walks around temples and engage in public ceremonies of praying against territorial spirits, because he says the Hindus are now coming to him and saying, look, you Christians are no different than we are. You believe in the same magic we do. You're chasing the same gods we chase. There's no difference between us. And there's no reason for me to consider Christ or Christianity as something different from what I already believe in. You can have a feel for where I'm coming from in terms of some of the territorial spirit engagement that I see taking place, but this is in part because of the magical thinking that we've seen. Spiritual warfare has become, in a wonderful way for me, because I teach in this area, it's become wonderfully an item of agenda within the church, but at the same time, it's following a fadism of how it approaches that. And I think people are well-meaning and well-intentioned, but they're tending to buy the magical thinking and bring that in. And we see this in mission circles. A second thing is down-aging, what Faith Popcorn, who is a researcher of trends in the West, calls down-aging. People who are retiring who aren't acting their age. They are down-aging instead of downsizing. And so instead of retiring and going off quietly into oblivion, they're getting involved. They're doing things. They're active. And one of the things that we're beginning to see here is an increasing number of retirees, for example, in the world system, in Peace Corps. Peace Corps, the last numbers I saw, have approximately 12% of their volunteers are retirees. So it's not just the young college graduates anymore. We're seeing the same thing in short-term missions, and even in some long-term missions as well, too. People starting second careers after retirement. By the way, it's far easier for a retiree to raise support because many of them don't need to, because they have their retirement and their pension funds set up, and they are free financially to be able to be used of the Lord in a variety of flexible ways. A second thing that we... Yeah. That... It's the church reflecting the culture. If I were to trace that back, J. Gordon Melton is a well-known cult researcher, and he follows these type of trends. And I want you to hear me carefully in what I'm saying, because this is something that can be used in the wrong way, in a form of neo-tribalism, and I want to avoid this. But he says here in the West, one of the biggest impacts was not just what took place in the 60s, and for example, the Beatles getting involved with alternate religions, but we also repealed the Asian Immigration Exclusion Act in 1964. What amounted to there was instead of getting only refugee population from other world religious areas, we were getting people who had an intact faith coming into our country. And you see this, for example, in the temple in North Aurora, the Hindu temple that's not built because a lot of people in India decided they wanted to evangelize in the West. That's because a lot of people immigrated out of Hindu context, and there are enough of them that they want to be able to worship within the context that they feel comfortable with, within their own religion. And refugees tend to come broken, but people who are immigrating who are not refugees come with a more of an intact faith. And so we've seen an influx of alternate spiritualities in this context. I think it's a wonderfully refreshing thing that challenges us to rethink our faith. At the same time, we have seen that anthropologists have traced the rise of magical thinking in our culture. I've seen the literature go back as early as the mid-70s to say how we have become an increasingly magic culture. We see this in trends in satanic crime. We see this in the rise of and plethora of New Age thinking and ideas. And it's not the conspiracy that Dave Hunt makes it out to be. But it is a framework and a worldview that is different from what we had seen as Christians in the 30s, 40s, 50s in this culture. And part of it was due to some of our disillusionment with what technology was doing to us. And so at least these are the types of things that people are tracing as trends here. And the church is walking in those footsteps. To me, the biggest sign that this had taken place in the church was the popularity of Peretti's novel. The fact that they were crossover novels, you would find them at Walden Bookstore, just as you would at Family Bookstore with Donovan. You could find them all over the place. They were just as popular in the larger culture as they were in the church. But when I talk on spiritual warfare in churches, I have found an average of 50 to 70% of the people in the churches have read at least one of Peretti's novels. But no one can name one or two other authors in spiritual warfare. You know, so for me, Peretti was he didn't lead the charge. He was writing on a charge that had already taken place, but we weren't willing to admit. And so there's that side of it that I'm seeing. Okay. I see it on a regular basis. I've got a guy that called me over the course of about 6 months, and literally the last telephone conversation I had, hi, Dr. Moreau, this is, what's his name? I ate a chicken sandwich for lunch today. Am I going to lose my salvation? And I said, what? And he said, well, I made a vow this morning that I wouldn't eat lunch, and then I ate it, I broke down, and the demon voices are telling me. And so you've got people who are ascribing a lot of things to the demonic, some of which need to be ascribed to the demonic. I want you to hear me on that side. But some of which don't need to be ascribed to the demonic, but it's easier to find an enemy outside of myself than it is inside. Think of the rogue nations. How do they keep themselves internally intact? Often it's they go to war against other countries, and by declaring another country to be the enemy, it's easier for us to ignore the problems that are happening inside. And I see some of this thinking taking place on the individual level, not just the political level. Yeah. What is which in these cases? Yeah. I'll say this here, even though I might, maybe shouldn't, but to do that, you have to take a course that I teach in spiritual warfare. So. Woo! Another trend I see is called cashing out, and this is the finishers, the generation that's in this 45 to 60 range, who decides, I've had enough of the rat race, I'm going to cash out, I'm going to put myself into early retirement. And in the secular world, I'm going to go out, I'm going to leave New York City, I'm going to go start a bed and breakfast in Upper Ohio. Or I'm going to move down to Texas and maybe open a little restaurant or something like that. They want to just get out of the rat race as they see it. Whether Texas or Ohio or out of the rat race in New York is something that could be debated. But we're going to see people, in evangelicals, who are also increasingly interested in cashing out as well, too. And hopefully the church is going to be in a position to help them think through careers of ministry, where certainly significance has an opportunity to offer something, or careers in mission, where we have the opportunity to offer significance for them as well, too. We also see families redefined. And if you want to think of this in terms of the busters versus the boomers, the sitcom Friends exemplifies this. Groups of people living together and having that become their family unit. One of the things we're seeing here at Wheaton College is students increasingly coming out of brokenness in their background, at the same time, by and large, being less foundationally grounded in the Scripture. We can assume less on a regular basis of the foundation people carry with them into their college time, and they're going out into an ever-increasingly complex world. And so we as a department recognize if we don't meet the personal issues that people face, we're preparing a lot of failures. And so we seek to design our courses where we have people look at themselves internally and personally, and it's not just academic exercises. Now, some of you who are students of mine would be able to argue or agree with that, but that's what we try and do in our coursework here at the college, at least within the missions department, because of the increasing brokenness. And it's an interesting thing. The Gen Xers want to go out as teams of people that they feel comfortable with, which is fine. But the same dysfunctionality that resulted in a family breakdown, they carry that with them into the teams. And so the same dysfunctionality that was part of the family now becomes part of the mission team, which is trying to plant a church in Kazakhstan with cultural pressures weighing on them, the women having to wrestle through issues of what it's like to be a woman in a Muslim culture, and the men trying to figure out what in the world is going on with all this sense of oppression that I feel, or all of them feeling, and the teams imploding or exploding, depending on what the case might happen to be. This doesn't mean it's always going to happen. I'm painting a worst-case scenario of what can take place. But this is some of the dynamics that we have to prepare people for, and the mission agencies are very slow to be acknowledging accepting teams rather than accepting individuals. This is going to be one of the biggest shifts. I was just at a meeting on Friday at O'Hare Airport with Dan Harrison, who's the director of InterVarsity. He is thinking of joining with another ministry. He left InterVarsity staff now, and he's going to join another ministry. And this was a brainstorming proposal for this particular ministry. that he was trying to take into account these types of changes that are taking place. We're going to start to see some organizations moving that direction, but most don't see it at all. They take people purely on an individual basis, where we're starting to see more students come out of the college as well, too, saying, I want to work with a team, and here are three of the people that I've identified already that are going to be part of my team. I think that's what I'll leave it at in terms of the trends in the West that I see. What's another, again, the global economy, the migration, neo-tribalism, rogue nations, the information age, the world religions, and the crime. And then maybe next week we'll carry on with some of this as well, too, with Doug McConnell. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the information age certainly as a whole is something that has increasingly captivated those of us in the West in a positive way in terms of making information available to us. The very fact that I can tell you there's an estimated $4.5 trillion in crime is a product of the information age. In part, it's our ability to gather, and some of these are massaged numbers, obviously, and they're numbers based on assumptions. But we have the increasing ability to gather information, but information is now becoming a commodity. By the way, this is another generation trend that I see. People of the younger generation tend to treat information as a piece or a commodity that can be used or not used, as seems to, and then thrown away and pulled back up when necessary. By the way, how does the Bible become something more than just another piece of information in that type of worldview? And that's one of the issues I'm seeing taking place that's on the downside of information management. But we have more information than we know what to do with. A couple of years ago, and this was before I'm at where I am right now, what I can do in my office, I went over to the library because I was interested in this particular subject called multiple personality disorder. And I wanted to find out what was going on. So I got onto the databases, and I started at 1:30 in the afternoon. By 5 o'clock, I had a 42-page, 8-pitch font, tiny, bibliography that was annotated on every source, 381 sources in 10 years of the literature. Where am I going to have time to read 381 sources? Where are any of us? Unless we, you know, and by the time you read the 381, 12,753 new sources would have been added to it. Part of the thing is the overwhelmingness of the information that we're having to deal with. But secondly, I'd say in the missions world, we're seeing several trends that I want to mention. Number one is broadcasting. We're seeing a good increase, not just in the mega broadcasting ministries, and I'm not talking just 700 club type of things, but I'm talking even smaller groups that are setting up miniature FM stations to transmit in a local dialect and then providing people with very cheap radios that they can, that are, as a matter of fact, radios that don't tune to anything but the station. How's that for keeping them cheap? All you need is a volume dial or an on-off dial if you want to keep it that way. And so these can be provided cheaply to enable people in remote regions to keep track of things. But we also have an increase in missionaries using email to keep in touch with home. On the positive side, many missionaries find their first year or two of service is becoming easier because the feeling of being distant from your relatives and knowing what's going on has been greatly lowered. At the same time, my fear is that missionaries will spend 6 hours a day writing and receiving email and not serve the people they're there to work among. The Indian missionary that I mentioned to you, while he went back to India, he said his first year back he did not carry a computer for that very reason. He wanted to get into the lives of the people. He wanted, 25 years gone, language skills were not the best, so he wanted a year of reworking his language skills and a year of getting to know people, spending time with them, having tea with them, enjoying them as people. And then he came back after and said, now I can bring the computer back because I've gotten my feet on the ground in the right way. So there are pros and cons to that. On one side, however, we're seeing a lot of prayer networks set up. There's a group called Speed the Need, and you can send an email prayer request to them, and they have, I think it's between 5 and 10,000 people on their mailing list. They'll send it out via email, and I'll receive it at my desk, and I'll know, well, here's something I need to pray for. So we're opening up interesting doors in terms of mobilizing mass prayer very quickly in ways that would have taken months just a few years ago for people to find out what was going on. We also have in the information age tools available to us such as the Jesus film, the most widely distributed and translated film that history has ever seen. Whether that's positive or negative could be argued, because in tribal peoples who have never seen a movie before, when Jesus walks off screen, they wonder where he went. They don't have an understanding of that type of media necessarily. At the same time, many of the audiences get to see him in a less Western form than they're used to thinking of him. And it opened up in their hearts new ways to see him as Savior. And it gives a greater response to him, though the movie is 20 years old now, and for those of us viewing it in the West, it's outdated in terms of its special effects, and we'd love to say, let's remake it. And, we could do a Terminator 2 type of have Jesus transform himself. And well, we don't need to do that for many parts of the world that aren't used to the latest in the technology that's there. I will say also, in terms of unreached peoples, we have more information available. I had a student come to me and say, what can we find on the World Wide Web about the Telugu in northern Tanzania? So I typed in the word on to search for this word, and I found six or seven different pieces of information on them. One is a database, a Christian database, on what the status of evangelization of these people is. Another is a Wycliffe ethnologue that tells what the status is of scripture translation and distribution is, and who the people are, where they're located. So Christians are starting to make information available and accessible. One very interesting tool that I have been using is called the African Proverbs Project. It's a single CD-ROM with 30,000 African proverbs, all of them given an English translation, many of them an explanation, 23 full-length books just on proverbs and what use there is for them in the culture, all on a single CD-ROM disk that I could carry with me to Africa if I was going to return there for work. And the purpose of global mapping, which put this together, is to make these available in the hands not of you and I, but in the hands of third world people. The problem is, of course, they need a computer to be able to access it, but more and more we're seeing some of that come up. These are some of the trends that I'm seeing in terms of the information technology. Yes. In chat room forums, the negatives are there, but there are positive examples available. Wheaton, the Billy Graham Center, will be hosting a conference on internet evangelism in April as well, too. And if any of you are interested in following up on that, that is, Tony, I think, have you been involved with some of that as well, too? Yeah, and Tony would be a good resource person as well, too, to check into, see what types of things are there. Interestingly enough, when I was doing research on Satanism in the United States for a little article I wrote, I got onto the web, and a lot of satanic groups have their own web pages. Now, some of you, that might be a frightening thing to go out. Well, it's there, and that's part of the thing that I needed as a researcher to be able to look at. But interestingly enough, among the satanic web pages was a page on how you should witness to us. Because they're tired of Christians tossing John 3:16 out at them and not sticking around to find out the results. They say, here are five rules or six rules or seven rules. If you're going to witness to us, number one, treat us as people, not as objects of your evangelistic foray. Number two, give us the ability to reason just as you have the ability to reason, and let's talk about things. And, and they have a whole list of things that they want people, because they're used to seeing this. Christians get into the groups and they well-intentioned but not well-thought-through evangelistic methodologies. And so just as we can abuse people by shoving facts down their throat, we can shove email messages down their throat as well. So there's positive and negative on that. But it is an exciting thing that you can witness to people that you would never have access to before. Do that. Yeah. You're right, but I think the big difference is in what environment are we raising our children. And if they are raised in an environment that focuses on this information age and information as a commodity, it's going to be hard for them with the attention spans that they will develop as a result to be able to sit through a 30 to 40 minute sermon and be impacted by it. And I would say this is not as much an impact yet in the church, it will be in about 20 years, as it is among the unchurched. Those who have never been to church before. The sermon is a vehicle that for many of them just is antiquated and needs to be rethought. Now, whether we agree with that or not is an issue the church needs to wrestle with, but that's a reality of the worldview of many people. I look at my own four daughters, ages 15 months to 10 years. We're bringing them up in a church environment, but I think of their friends who are not being brought up in a church environment, and many of them don't have the attention span that's going to get them through a sermon and let it have an impact in their life. And so the sermon as a vehicle of communication might need to be rethought in certain circles in the world, especially circles being largely impacted by this. I'm going to leave it at that because that's a hot potato statement, isn't it? And I can see I'm out of time. Oh. But we'll come back next week and maybe pick up on some of these things again as well, too. I'd love to have suggestions that you'd like to see. We're here for three more weeks. I thought I would kind of get the ball rolling to tell you some of the things we're seeing. And if you have suggestions, let's hear them.
Good. Here's a chance.